From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in a prison in the state of Kentucky. It is like hundreds of prisons across the country, the ostensibly temporary home for inmates who have done wrong, but will get another shot in society after they've served their time. And that's what prison is all about, right? Punishing for wrongdoing, but also for preparing inmates for a fresh start. Or maybe not. A new book pulls back the cover on the prison system in a way that exposes just how little the system does to prepare inmates to become productive members of society. In fact, the system seems to count on inmates to reoffend and come right back. The book is called Mr. Smith Goes to Prison. The author is Jeff Smith, a former Missouri state senator who was sentenced to 1 year and 1 day in prison for an elections offense. Once inside, Smith decided to write a book about his experience, and that book has become a kind of blueprint for what could be done to improve recidivism and dramatically alter a system that is bent on punishment but not on reform. This hour, we'll explore Jeff's time in prison, what he thinks can be done, and we'll take your comments and questions as well. Let me welcome Jeff Smith to Connections. And Jeff, how are you?
I'm great, Evan. How you doing? Hope you had a good Thanksgiving.
Well, very good, and I appreciate you taking the time to join us. You know, what I want to do is just kind of tell our listeners a little bit about your own background, because you are such an interesting voice in this debate, because your background is so unusual. You're, you know, this short, slight white guy who took an interest in African-American studies and even considered a career in it before you got into politics. Can you tell us more about that?
Sure. So I went to a high school that was part of the nation's largest voluntary desegregation program in suburban St. Louis. So I grew up about 15 minutes from downtown and went to a high school that was mostly white but accepted kids who came out on buses from inner city St. Louis. And I was had a dad who was a grandpa who was a pro tennis player, a dad who was a college golf coach, and dreamed that I would be an NBA basketball player. The problem was that I'm 5'6". So anyway, long story short, he groomed me to be a basketball player, and I was the only white guy on my high school basketball team, and I was the captain of the team, and basically, you know, that was a huge part of my life. I ended up coaching basketball at a boys' club in St. Louis for about a decade, and that got me, kind of piqued my interest in African-American history, because I saw the huge disparities between the education that I received in my suburban high school and that which most of my teammates received before they came to my high school. And so I majored in African American studies, came back to St. Louis and worked in St. Louis public schools, and ended up co-founding a group of charter schools in the city of St. Louis as well. So spent a lot of my time, and then ultimately, and we're fast forwarding a little bit, but ultimately represented a majority black state Senate district in St. Louis. So race was a big part of my life in a lot of ways, and as we've all seen over the last year and a half, St. Louis really struggles with race and is very polarized.
And so what landed you in prison is not nearly as interesting as what happened inside that prison, but let's talk a little bit about what got you in there. You know, you, at the age of 29, you had this long shot bid. You decided, I'm going to run for Congress, and you wanted to run against a Carnahan, which is like the version of the Kennedys in Missouri, and you almost won. You came, 1,800 votes or so away from winning a seat in Congress. Is that right?
That's right, yeah.
Okay, and so what was it, though, that locked the feds in on you? Because even when I go back to your book and kind of read through it, I think, this gets a guy in prison. I don't mean to minimize, these sort of elections offenses, but people get away.
You're
with,
welcome to minimize it.
Well, but people get away with everything. It's amazing in this country when it comes to money in politics. But what got you in prison?
What got me in prison was that about a month before Election Day, two of my aides, when I was running for Congress, two of my aides came to me and said, this guy who bills himself as a practitioner of the political dark arts wants to put out a postcard about Carnahan's attendance record in the State House, which was one of the worst of any legislator up there. And so I said, instead of telling them, no, you're not allowed to like coordinate with any third-party group and anything, they said, you know, he wants us to give him the actual, like, attendance record of Carnahan's. And that was publicly available information. But instead of telling my aides, you know what, then tell him a website where he can find it, I said, don't tell me any details. I don't want to know what you do. And they said, okay, so we should talk to him. And I said, did you hear me? Don't tell me anything. They took that to mean exactly what I wanted them to interpret it as, which was tacit approval to go ahead and deal with him. A couple weeks later, about a week and a half before Election Day, I didn't think that postcard would ever come out, so I called a press conference at the federal courthouse in St. Louis, and I said, Russ Carnahan's a nice guy, but he doesn't show up for work very much. The next day, the postcard that the third-party guy wanted to put out actually comes out. It lacks a paid-for-by disclaimer, and it contains the same information, essentially, that I had said the day before publicly. That seeming connection causes Carnahan to file a complaint with the Federal Election Commission alleging illegal coordination between my campaign and the third-party group that, in his mind, constituted an illegal circumvention of campaign finance law. And he was essentially right, because my staff shouldn't have given that guy the voting information. They could have said, here's a website where you can find it, but they couldn't have. It was illegal to provide that. I lose by a little more than 1%. A week later, I file a response to the Federal Election Commission complaint, which was an affidavit that contained 15 statements, 14 true, one of them false. The false one saying, I knew nothing at all about the postcard in advance. 5 years later, when I was in the state Senate, my best friend called me and told me that the man who put out that postcard had been picked up by the feds for wife beating, illegal weapons possession, mortgage fraud, bank fraud, wire fraud, drug distribution, and was the chief suspect in the car bombing that nearly killed his ex-wife's divorce lawyer.
Wow.
I'd wanted to win that first campaign 5 years earlier so badly that I let my aides deal with this monster. And so for the next couple months, my best friend and I talked about what we would do if this guy facing these charges decided to give me up and my campaign aides. And little did I know that entire time my best friend was wearing a wire.
Okay, and so they got you.
So that's how they got me.
Sorry that
it took me a couple minutes to get
to that. No, that's okay. So that's what gets you in prison. And I appreciate the fact that you own it now. I mean, you certainly do it in the book, Mr. Smith Goes to Prison, and you say that you weren't proud of what you did. And even though people have not gone to prison for a lot worse than what you did, you own it. And you earned that title of felon, and there you are. So you go to prison for a year and a day, and you went, well, let's start with this. What prison did you go to, Jeff?
I went to prison in kind of deep southeast Kentucky, a town called Clay County, which the New York Times last year called the most miserable county in the country because of its sky-high rates of poverty, drug addiction, just general unemployment. You know, it's a tough place, very poor.
Okay, and as you helpfully explain in the book, there is a breakdown of maximum, essentially five levels of prison. And I think Americans generally think about prison as we think of the supermaxes and then we think about everything else. But you were in a minimum security prison, and I'm curious to know what you expected the experience to be like going in.
So I lived in a minimum. I worked at a medium,
right,
which was on the same campus as the one where I lived. And, you know, I didn't really come in expecting a certain thing. I hoped that there would be a large contingent of white-collar offenders. That was not the case. It was about 99% drug dealers. Most of them had a gun on their case because they had been, when they were caught, they either were holding a gun or had a gun in their house or their car. And so it was probably about 60% people in for crack and about 35% or so people in for meth or oxy, then a few random people who were in for assault with a deadly weapon or something like that if they beat someone up on a cruise ship or in a post office, that is something which made it a federal offense as opposed to state, but primarily drug dealers.
We're talking to Jeff Smith. His new book is Mr. Smith Goes to Prison, What My Year Behind Bars Taught Me About America's Prison Crisis. And the storytelling is really, really effective in this book. It helps you see what it is like day to day right from the start. And you get assigned a cellie, a roommate, a prison inmate, a fellow inmate. And I love it. His nickname is Red. Tell us why Red, Jeff.
He bore a striking resemblance to Morgan Freeman's character in Shawshank Redemption.
And he really did in real life, huh?
He really did, yeah. Had the same kind of freckles, you know, kind of rare, that you don't see that much on black guys.
So just about everybody in the book's got a nickname, and you were Senator, which makes a lot of sense.
I actually had a few different nicknames. Some called me Senator. When I first got there, they started calling me 90210.
Yeah.
thankfully, that one didn't stick. And then on the basketball court, they called me White Chocolate.
We're going to get there, but let's start with Red, because I got the sense early on that you appreciated his wisdom. This was a guy who'd been in there and knew the system very intimately, offered you some, at times, advice on how to behave and how not to behave. Did you know early on that you had somebody who would at least help you see what the sort of ethical code was?
I really appreciated the fact that he and a few other guys in my cell block took the time to tell me what things were going to be like. They could see, obviously, that I had no experience with prison and that I was going to need a primer. So that was immensely helpful to me. Most guys, when they get there, they got to show their paperwork. That means they've got to have someone send in their case file so that other people on the cell block can determine whether or not they snitched. Fortunately, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, the newspaper from my hometown, there were a couple other guys from St. Louis who got the paper, and they had read about my case, and so they knew that although my best friend had worn a wire on me, I didn't wear a wire on anyone or receive a cooperation agreement with the feds, and that kind of put me in good stead originally. So that was kind of the first key rule that they explained to me was, like, if you're a snitch, you're basically going to have the worst year of your life if you survive it. So having kind of some awareness of my case by the couple guys there from St. Louis was tremendously helpful.
And yet you get this help from Red, but you go to sit down and eat. You figure, well, I can sit down and eat with Red. The first time you went, you sit down with black inmates to eat. What happened?
Well, you see, Red and everybody else in my cell block when I got there was black. And I naturally thought, I think like a normal human being, since they're the only people I know in the whole place, I'm going to take my tray and sit at their table. And within 20 seconds, everybody went silent. And, you know, I took a bite of my food, and then Red looked at me and said, you know, basically, he said, how many white folks do you see eating with the kinfolk? And I looked around, and I said, I guess none. And he basically said, well, look, you know, like, I don't know you, you know, like, and don't think that we're going to jump in to protect you if it jumps off, because, like, basically, as they explained, like, you don't eat with members of another race. That's just a total no-no at prison. So I walked outside, threw my food out, and within 2 minutes, a white guy, an Aryan Brotherhood former Aryan Brotherhood member, had collared me and explained to me in no uncertain terms that I should absolutely not ever eat with black people.
What was his name, by the way?
Cornbread.
Cornbread. Cornbread grabs you and says you're not to eat with them. What did that moment do for you, seeing the segregation? I mean, we live in a segregated world, right? We've seen that in Ferguson, in St. Louis. We see it in Rochester. But inside a prison system, you can't even sit down and eat with your cellmate. What did that do to you? What did that say to you?
You know, it injected me with, like, even more humility than getting prosecuted, perhaps. Because it told me that, like, anything that you try to do here is any effort you make to do the kinds of things that you've spent your life trying to do to build bridges between, you know, blacks, whites, whoever, it's futile, because you're up against something that's so much bigger than you. And so not only can you not do any good in that way, but if you even make any effort, then you're endangering your life, was basically the message. So, you know, I thought about it for a minute. I listened to the language that Cornbread used, just, you know, constantly using the N-word. And I thought to myself, you know, in any other realm, I would never let someone talk like that. And I would immediately say, don't ever say that around me. And, of course, knowing that there was no gang of, you know, Jewish lawyers or accountants to have my back at that moment, I decided, you know what, I'm just going to let this slide and walk away.
Talking to Jeff Smith, his remarkable new book is called Mr. Smith Goes to Prison, What My Year Behind Bars Taught Me About America's Prison Crisis. And, you know, you could have said, but hey, guys, I majored in African American studies. I was the only white guy in my basketball team growing up. And I have an appreciation for certain parts of culture and history and a sensitivity to that. That wouldn't have done you much good either.
I'm sure you're joking there, Evan, right?
Did you ever consider it, though?
I got to tell you, like, there's, I didn't tell white people, I didn't tell black people, I didn't tell anybody. You know, of course, there was a natural desire in me to think, you know what, I'd love for the black prisoners here, since most of the prisoners were black, to understand where I'm coming from and that, you know, I'm not like most, you know, a lot of these guys that are, you know, Kentucky born and bred, a lot of them affiliated with the Aryan Brotherhood or you know, some other organization, a couple guys that were in there for cross burning and things like that. I would have loved to have get that message across, but I didn't dare mention that even to black guys because I didn't want that to get out, you know, more to the white guys and cause me trouble.
So throughout this book, if there was a single theme to me and one that made me angry, it was not only that our prison system doesn't do a good job of preparing inmates to be productive members of society, but essentially assumes they will fail, laughs about it, and occasionally profits off of it. And I had a hard time reading what you had to write about corrections officers, the COs, who often show up making fun of inmates, joking with inmates when they're released that they'll be back, not doing much to kind of reach out and find out ways that these men are productive and could be productive on the outside world. When you went to prison, you must have known that the system doesn't do a good job of preparing inmates for the outside world. But was there a single thing that shocked you the most about that, Jeff?
You know, I knew a little bit about it because when I had been a lawmaker in Missouri, I had been, since my district contained a lot of people who had family members who were incarcerated, I was interested in criminal justice issues. I sponsored and ultimately passed legislation that reduced sentences for certain offenders who struggle to pay child support, for example, and ensured that instead of getting jail sentences, many of them would have alternative sentences. And so I had studied, you know, recidivism from sort of a policy perspective, but I was still shocked to see just the total disregard that the prison staff had for, I guess the best way to put it would be they had no discernible interest in the rehabilitation of inmates. Nowhere did I learn that better than seeing the educational and vocational offerings that were available to us. There were a total of three things that were offered during my year there. The first was a 2-week course in hydroponics, which is basically how to grow tomatoes in water. What could better prepare you for the outside?
Sure, right.
Right. Learning that.
Right.
And that turned out to basically just be a vehicle for one of the COs to take home hundreds of free tomatoes. The second offering was a GED course, which was taught by a prisoner. And because the prison made it clear that they didn't really care about the outcomes, some inmates who were assigned to the class or were supposed to be enrolled in the class wouldn't go and didn't really take it seriously. No one appeared to take it seriously. The third and final offering was a pre-release course in computer skills. I think I write about this in the book. We walked into a room where there were 10 brand new computers that we had basically been salivating at for the whole year, and we were told to sit down behind a computer after we signed in on a form. We were told to turn the computer on. I remember the CEO said, you know, find the little button on the bottom right. Deep Appalachian accent. He said, find the little button on the bottom right of the computer. Now push it in. That'll turn your computer on. We all did that and waited about 2 minutes, and he didn't say anything else. And another prisoner said, well, CO, now should we, and the CO said, shut the fuck up. And so we all sat there for another 40 minutes or so in silence. And after 40 minutes, the CO kind of laughs and says, all right, y'all remember that little button on the bottom right? I need you to push it again. And then get the back to your cell. So
that was it.
The computer skills course But, of course, the most important thing from the prison's perspective, it appeared, was that they could, because we had all signed in, let the federal government know that we had completed this computer skills class. And they could probably, I know they got stipends for every prisoner who completed a course. So, you know, that was indicative of the mentality of the prison where I was. I'm not saying that's how every prison operates. We'll probably get a call in from someone who, you know, works at a prison or it works for the BOP who says that's not how Otisville is, or that's not how another prison is, but I'm just offering my experience. And what I saw was a total lack of concern for the rehabilitation of inmates or anything to equip them with skills that would help them succeed in the world.
All right, well, I want to read an email from a listener in just a second. And on the question of what our listeners think, I'd love to hear from you on this program as we talk about recidivism, our prison crisis, what we do about prisons. And you can call the program. It's 844-295-TALK. Toll free, 844-295-8255. Or right here in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Lou emails the program and says, Evan, thanks for talking about this subject. Did your guest talk with inmates about banning the box? And the answer, Lou, is yes. It comes up often in the book. But let me step back and say we've talked about that in this program in the past. We've heard members of Rochester City Council talk about banning the so-called box. And Jeff writes about it in the book. Jeff, I want you to describe what we mean by banning the box for listeners who don't know. But also, in light of the computer class, it's a perfect example. Let's say you're an inmate who's been in 10 years. Let's say you've been in 20 years. You've never used the internet. You want to get out and you want to work. You want to be productive. And they basically blow off a 45-minute class so they can check their own box and get a stipend. What do they care about how inmates are doing when they get out? That says they don't care. They expect them back, and they're actually facilitating it. So tell me a little bit about banning the box here.
And before I do that, I'll just say that there was one CO who, whenever prisoners were getting ready to leave, he'd say, "See you in 6 months, jackass." And then he'd look at other prisoners.
Or worse, or a different language, yes, but yeah.
Oh, I apologize.
Well, I remember what he said on several occasions in the book, and it is deleted, or it would be expletive. See you in 6 months.
He used even more graphic language than that often.
Yes.
And, you know, essentially, this was his way, you know, and he would say explicitly, it's guys like you that remind me that I'm always going to have a job. You know, so they would just sort of goad you and kind of mock you for, you know, this horrible recidivism rate in our country. You know, about 2 out of every 3 people reoffend. And if you think about everything that goes on in prison, it shouldn't surprise any of us, right? Like, you're coming out of prison. In most cases, you had, a brutalizing, dehumanizing experience while you were there. You have been cleaned out of all your money, right? Especially drug offenders, because of our asset forfeiture laws, you're probably totally broke when you come back out. You don't have any job skills. You probably have a subpar education, right? I was totally different from the typical offender that I met. I had every advantage when I came out, right? Yeah, I had a PhD from a top university. I had tons of professional references. I had a cushion, you know, a financial cushion of like savings to fall back on in an emergency. And most guys have none of that. Right, so they come out totally broke. They got to pay for their halfway house room. They got to pay for drug testing. They've got to find money for transportation. They've got to find money for clothes to wear to a job interview. And they don't even have the skills to point and click to find a job listing. Right? You don't go to the newspaper's classified section anymore. You go to monster.com or, you know, wherever else you go in your local area to find job listings. And so we basically, you know, We make it so that we should all actually be surprised that 1 out of 3 people don't reoffend. You know, because the main indicator of whether or not people will is whether or not they have a job.
So,
and banning the box, to go back to your question,
yeah, right.
Basically the box is the box you have to check when you're coming back to look for employment after prison that says, yes, I have been convicted of a felony and here's what I did, and you have to explain it. If we expand that, as many cities in the country have done, then at least you allow people to have a second chance to go through the process and not spend their whole life paying for something they may have done decades ago that in many cases isn't even relevant to the job they're applying for. Now, I understand that if you're a pharmacist, you probably don't want to hire someone who just got out of prison for smuggling oxy. But that doesn't mean that you can't hire that person to be a groundskeeper at a park. And it just doesn't make sense, you know, to have this, you know, to continue to discriminate against people for something that in many cases they did long ago that's totally unrelated to the job at hand.
All right. Well, before I get to the phones, and we've got a number waiting to join the conversation, including someone who has volunteered at a prison. Before we get to those phones, Jeff, let me just follow up and say, I know some of our listeners will say that pharmacist question is the perfect example of why you can't ban the box, because if someone has smuggled oxy and a pharmacist isn't allowed to ask them that, aren't you putting people at risk?
And I'll be candid with you, which is that I've already changed my mind from when I wrote that, from when I wrote the book, you know, which, you know, I wrote most of that about a year ago and actually started jotting down notes on napkins and toilet paper 5 years ago for the book when I was incarcerated. But I don't think you should have a total blanket banning of the box. I think you should have employer should have the ability to ask, like a pharmacist should have the ability to ask, have you ever been convicted of a drug-related felony? Because it's directly applicable to the job. Unless something can be shown to be directly applicable, then I don't think you should be able to ask about it.
All right, so you think there should be exceptions to banning the box as related to the work at hand?
Exactly.
Okay, and before I go to the phones as well, just to follow up on Lou's question, he said, the inmates that you were in there with, did they talk or know about banning the box?
Sure, yeah, they knew all about it because many of them were in prison for their second or third time and talked about the struggles they had finding a job the last time they were free, because of the initial conviction. So, yes, they knew about it. Yes, they understood that they basically had, they had very long odds that they were going to be facing when they went back out in the community, and they would have loved to have seen some public policy solutions. There were three or four guys that I talked about legislative life with frequently, talked about public policy stuff a lot. I applied to teach four or five different courses while I was there, one of them being a public policy course, but all of my applications were turned down. Instead, I was assigned to work in the prison warehouse. So I, with six other guys, moved about 35,000 to 40,000 pounds of food that came in every day.
Which is just another example of how the prison system, which is supposed to be designed to, again, sure punish, but also rehabilitate and maybe make the best use of skills. Jeff is someone who has taught, was willing to teach. Instead, at how much did you weigh when you went to prison?
117.
117 pounds. You're hauling 80-pound bags of food because that's what they wanted you to do, to kind of make an example that they don't curry favor to a former politician instead of using the skills. Really remarkable stuff in the book, Mr. Smith Goes to Prison. We have a lot more to talk about. We're going to get a short break in here. Susie, Peta, Patricia, we're coming to you on the phones. We're also going to talk about the fact that before you get this idea that Jeff is saying prisoners don't have skills, he's saying they don't have training, especially for the modern job world. But there are a lot of skills on display in prison. In fact, Jeff thinks in many ways that those skills can translate to business ownership, management, entrepreneurialism, and that there's a big missed opportunity. We're going to talk about that and get your phone calls when we come back with Jeff Smith. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on The Next Connections, with the climate talks going on in Paris, the Fast Forward Film Festival is getting ready to come back to Rochester. It's a spotlight on local films, 5 minutes or less, looking at the environment. And we're going to meet some of the filmmakers and hear all about that project. And speaking of Spotlight, the film called Spotlights at the Little Theater tells the story of how the Boston Globe uncovered a scandal. We'll talk about that as well.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from the University of Rochester's Humanities Center. The center's inaugural lecture series continues with upcoming lectures in January and March. For more information, visit rochester.edu/college/humanities. And Renova Solar, serving upstate New York with the design and installation of solar power systems for home and business. More information at renovasolar.com.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. My guest is Jeff Smith, the author of the new book, Mr. Smith Goes to Prison. Talks about his year behind bars, incarcerated because when he ran for Congress about a dozen years ago, he was caught in an elections offense that earned him a year in prison. And so this former congressional candidate and former state senator went to prison, and even with his policy background, was surprised at what he saw there in terms of the system's sort of lack of interest in really helping rehabilitate and prepare inmates for the outside world. Let's get some of your phone calls in. Susie in Rochester wants to weigh in. Hi, Susie.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You know, I came into the show late, so I don't know if everything you covered, but I did hear you say, Evan, that you got angry and you were surprised at what you were reading about the conditions in the prisons. I volunteer in the prison up here near Rochester. And I'm bothered that you and Mr. Smith, who was an elected representative, were surprised at the conditions, because while there may be some good prisons, some good jails, my experience and those of other volunteers that I know, my experience is that this kind of situation is rampant, that you have not only the correction officers, the guards, who have attitudes toward the inmates, they have attitudes toward the volunteers, toward families. And it feels like there's no system of accountability, just like the guard and the situation with the computers, having the inmates sit there for 40 minutes doing nothing. There's no checks and balance to correct that kind of behavior. And people are afraid to say anything about it because of their concern for retaliation by the system. And we wonder why inmates and people who care about them are angry at the system. It's because we know that it doesn't care. Anybody who spends any time in the prison system can observe the conditions that aren't intended to rehabilitate people. The inmates and everybody who cares knows that the system makes money off of the inmates by paying them pennies for the work they do. They know that they're, in too many cases, incarcerated unfairly, and then when they get out, they still are at a serious disadvantage. So I'm holding you to a higher standard, Evan, because I would have wanted you to have been aware of that, and I hope you'll do more shows bringing these kinds of conditions to light, because we need to have a serious overhaul in our penal system. Thanks for taking this call.
Susie, thanks for the phone call, and that's fair enough. We're all trying to learn more about the system and evaluate it. And look, I'm not here endorsing everything Jeff says, and we'll push back a little bit between now and the rest of the hour, and I'm sure Jeff's heard plenty of pushback. But Jeff, what are some of your thoughts about what you just heard from Susie?
Well, I had actually spent some time in prisons as a legislator. I used to go and see something called the Prison Performing Arts Program, where prisoners in Missouri would perform Shakespeare. And I would try to get my fellow colleagues in the Senate to go, because I wanted them to understand that the people who were incarcerated were humans too and had talents and, you know, interests and passions in the same way that anyone else does. Unfortunately, none of my colleagues would ever go with me, but I did get a little bit of an inkling when talking to the actors after the plays about life inside. And so I can't say that I was shocked by anything that I saw, but I have to say that having my own experience in Missouri prisons was sort of a self-selected one. It was seeing the guys who were allowed to participate in these theatrical performances and nurture something inside of them, when what I ended up seeing was just a total, kind of oppression, you know, and no interest in nurturing any of these sparks. So that was what surprised me. But, you know, the caller's point is well taken.
And Susie, you're right. There are parts of the book that do illustrate how prisoners, how inmates are scared of the system. Jeff, you're right yourself about the fact that you were warned that a book might not be sanctioned. It might be viewed as you running a business illegally from inside the prison just because you were scribbling notes to write a book, so you had to hide your notes. That's true, right?
Yeah, I actually had to hide my notes in another guy's cell.
Okay.
Because my own cell got swept frequently.
They didn't want you writing a book. And then one of the guys who did some of the sweeps, and one of the more egregious characters, does the sweep and finds that you've got 5 books, and he claims you're only allowed to have 3 and takes some of the books away. So you'd think that they would want inmates reading, doing things like that, And there was supposed to be a 5-book limit, not 3. He broke that rule, but no one's going to call him on it. What are you going to do, call him on it, right, when he takes 2 of your books away? What good is that going to do you as an inmate?
Yeah, I mean, the surest way to get yourself what's called diesel therapy is to complain or to file a formal complaint. Diesel therapy is when you get put on a bus with your legs and your arms chained, and basically driven and flown around the country from county jail to county jail, holding cell to holding cell for like 6 months to a year. That's what they do to prisoners who file complaints on the guards. So people kind of learn that it's not a good tactic to take.
Patricia has been waiting to join the conversation. She's in Irondequoit. Next up. Go ahead, Patricia. Hi, Patricia. Are you there? Oh, we don't have her. Patricia, if you are there, call back, and let me get to Peta in Rochester. Peta, go ahead.
Hi there. This is Peta.
Go ahead.
At one time, I volunteered at Attica. I spent 39 years practicing medicine. I'm now doing something different. Thank you, Mr. Smith, for your book. I will be buying several copies and giving it to several of my friends. We could talk about so many topics. What I want to talk about is financial incentives. If we give corrections officers a financial incentive that their institution went from a recidivism rate of X down to a recidivism rate that is lower, let's say Y, and on a percentage basis, as their recidivism rate goes down, their bonus goes up meaningfully.
I'm so glad that you're asking. This is something I've been talking about on the road for the last 4 or 5 months since the book's been released, is how we could totally restructure the incentives. Because the incentives right now, in the eyes of most COs, are, I got to keep this guy down and beat him down, because if these 600 guys that I'm overseeing now all successfully reenter society and none of them ever come back, then one day I'm not going to have a job. If we totally, transform the incentive structure, as you described, Peta, right?
Correct.
Then we could turn that on its head, right? If we said, as you suggest, that if you track every releasee and you show that for every year that releasee flies straight and doesn't reoffend, then every CO in the last 2 institutions to house that person gets a $2,000 bonus, something like that, then instead of having the incentive be to beat that guy down, the incentive would be to lift that offender up.
Go ahead, Peta.
Meanwhile, if I may, I love men, I marry men, I date men, but I would submit to you that the rest of the world considers the United States extremely uncivilized because we have taken brutality and victimizing and made them incorrectly into male characteristics and admired and supported. Many parts of the world consider the entire system that America has for jails, such as once you have a felony, you cannot run for elective office. I have had people repeatedly who are Danish, who are French, tell me your system is obscene. And I would humbly submit that they are completely correct. My last comment, until recently in many states, corrections officers could get college credits and have their tuition paid for, as well as the inmates having college credits and getting their tuition paid for. And that has been largely done away with since we've introduced a profit-motivated private gulag of, a concentration camp system that we choose to ignore within our country. End of comments.
Peta, thanks for the phone call. Jeff, you addressed the question of education in your book in a couple of places. You mentioned the Bard College program. There was one other that you mentioned. We've talked on this program about the fact, I think it was about a year ago, New York State was looking at that, and it became very politically divided, as these things often do. And one of the arguments that Governor Cuomo and other supporters of educating inmates, one of the arguments they made was, look at it from a conservative side. Look at it from a cost-saving side. The cost of recidivism is very high to taxpayers, and if we spend a little bit to educate them and give them a better chance, then we save money in the long run. It didn't fly here. But what can you tell us about your thoughts, having been on the prison system on the inside? Education, would it make an impact? Would the inmates want it?
look, I think it can make a huge impact, and there's a lot of studies that corroborate that. The RAND Corporation just did a meta study where they studied, they analyzed dozens of studies of prison education programs around the country, and they showed that for every dollar we spend on prison education, we save about $6 in reduced recidivism-related costs once people are released. So we know that it can be very effective. Will prisoners want it? Yes, they will, as long as it's tailored to something that can help them get a job when they get out. Did they demand, did they say, oh, we've got to have a program in growing tomatoes and water? No, they didn't really care about that. They want to learn skills that are practical. And, you know, I probably talked to 20 different guys that had business plans that they were working on for landscaping businesses or laundromats or restaurants or personal training businesses, you know, all types of stuff. You know, there was one guy actually on my cell block who was running a successful business while a prisoner, you know, whose 19-year-old son was running it for him. It was a pornographic website, but that's a whole other story that you can find out if you read the book. The point is that there was not a single concept, a single business concept that you could learn at Harvard Business School or Wharton that you couldn't learn inside federal prison. Risk management, new product launch, quality control, supply chain management, barriers to entry, territorial expansion. They understood every one of these concepts through the drug trade. And they talked about it in somewhat different lingo than you'd hear at Wharton, but they were saying the same, you know, they understood these concepts. The sad thing was that there was no training to help them translate their intuitive grasp of these concepts into legitimate businesses on the outside. So, yes, I absolutely think there would be interest, and I absolutely think it could have a huge impact in reducing recidivism and saving taxpayers billions of dollars so that we didn't keep funding this revolving door that we currently fund.
Peta also says she thinks that we have essentially a barbaric system. You write about the hole or the shoe in your book. The SHU stands for what, Jeff?
Special housing unit.
A special housing unit. That's the shoe. That's the hole. That's solitary confinement. Do you think we should do away with it?
I think we should do away with it in all but the most extreme circumstances. If there's a prisoner that's tried to kill another prisoner, then he probably deserves to be isolated. But the things they're doing it for now are just ridiculous. You know, you can get in a shoe if you have too many pieces of bread in your cell. They can put you as the captain of the prison, who's like the number two to the warden and the head of discipline, as he threatened me one day. He said, you know, we could put you in the shoe for 6 months without even knowing that you did anything, just while you're under investigation. You know, and that's something that they did frequently, is just, you know, put people there while they looked into, you know, to things. So, yeah, I think it's dramatically overused and should only be used in the most extreme circumstances.
Andy writes to us, Evan, I have to say I'm loving what I'm hearing. This is exactly what prison should be like. Spread the word and fewer people will make the mistakes that put themselves there. What do you say to Andy, Jeff?
That I hope he's a wealthy man who wants to pay higher and higher taxes over the course of the next couple of decades, once that our prisons are totally dehumanizing and ensure that most of the people who go there will ultimately reoffend.
Ella wants to know if there are other countries or other places that your guest has found use a different system, and is it more effective?
Yeah, there's other places, and people like Andy, if they don't like paying taxes, because he sounds like maybe he's someone who doesn't like paying high taxes for prisoners, then they might look to countries like Denmark that have recidivism rates that are less than a fifth of our own rate. Recidivism rates around 10%, because the minute you go into a prison in Denmark, they do an assessment. They figure out what are your aptitudes, what do you bring to the table, and how can we equip you with more skills while you're incarcerated to make sure that you can go into the world and get a job. Because we know, and this is something that's consistent across nearly every country, the main indicator of whether or not you'll reoffend is financial struggle and unemployment. So in Denmark, they do this intake, and then they, in your last couple of years, they work to try to align your skills with the needs of employers and the community to which you'll return, and then help connect you with employment leads. If we operated more like that, like they do in several other countries, we could save billions and billions of dollars every year.
And before I get back to the phones, and we'll finish the hour with listener comments for Jeff Smith, my guest, who is the author of the new book, Mr. Smith Goes to Prison, What My Year Behind Bars Taught Me About America's Prison Crisis. What other solutions would you leave with the audience? What could change, Jeff, going forward that would give us a chance to essentially have a better justice system, which is penal but also reforming?
Well, look, it's punishment enough. It doesn't add. A lot of studies have shown over the last few years that prison increasingly has almost no deterrent effect. That is, putting more people in prison doesn't stop crime. Okay, we've long past, you know, reached the point where putting more people away is cost efficient and beneficial to public safety. So what should we do? Well, you know, we should change the way that our prisons operate. And one other thing that we haven't really touched on that much is the way that prisons work to prevent people from being in close contact with loved ones. In addition to educational advancement, we know that it helps reduce recidivism if people can stay in close touch with their family, their friends, their pastors, whoever, and then have community support while they're incarcerated. That keeps them from becoming institutionalized. It keeps them from becoming people who only see life as being a life inside of prison and don't see potential for the outside. Unfortunately, because prison phone calls and now video visits can cost $2, $3, $4 a minute, we make it cost prohibitive for people to stay in touch with loved ones. My wage while I was incarcerated was about $5, $5.25, not per hour, but per month for full-time work. I was different from most people because I had some savings, but if that's all the money you have and you have to pay not only for, you know, letters or phone calls, but you have to pay for basic hygiene. You got to buy your own soap. You got to buy deodorant, shampoo, toothpaste, toothbrush at prices that are 40% higher, you know, marked up from what you'd pay on the outside. So it makes it almost impossible for people to afford to stay in touch with loved ones. We need to take the profit motive out of out of prison. Get vendors out who are profiteering off the most vulnerable people in society and make it easier for people on the inside to stay in touch with loved ones so that the experience doesn't scar them for life as much as it currently does for most.
And there was a counterintuitive part of the book where you talked about the video conferencing where I thought, well, hey, this is modern technology. Prisoners can use video conferencing to stay in touch with family. But the exorbitant rates they're charging make that cost prohibitive, and all of a sudden you think that that would be a good thing. It ends up being something that the prison makes money off of. But I guess reading your book makes me think, well, that actually makes prisoners less likely to stay in touch, even though technology is better than ever.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right.
So let me get Dan in Rochester. Last phone call with Jeff Smith. Go ahead, Dan.
Yeah, I just wanted to relate. I have a relative who's been incarcerated for some years now. A year ago, you guys mentioned that it was a political football whether or not to bring college education back into the facilities. And around that time, in fact, and coincided with the governor's program to reduce the number of prisons, the paroles seemed to favor those who had violent pasts, and the opposite of that for those who were up for parole with nonviolent situations. And lo and behold, and I was alerted to this beforehand, but lo and behold, we had an officer killed by a violent offender who was on parole. We had a little girl raped. I think that these things were by design. Like I said, the order in which I was alerted to the things makes it pretty obvious to that fact, and I think there are many entities out there, that, including the unions, that want to see the recidivism rate stay the same.
All right, thanks for the phone call, Dan. Jeff Smith, go ahead.
I have never even thought about it being a concerted effort to do that. That would be one vile conspiracy, if that's really what's going on. And I can't comment on the specifics of it here in New York State. I don't know enough about the process, but I do know of many, many, many nonviolent offenders who have been denied parole you know, time and time again, and also violent offenders too. But if that indeed is what's taking place, then that would be a really sad commentary on the system.
All right, a couple more quick ones. Bob writes, COs have been put in positions of carrying out what our criminal justice system, legislators, judges, and the public want. It should be understood that the impact of being locked in cages and its impacts on prisoners also have impacts on correctional officers. COs are locked in a big cage in 8-hour shifts, 5 days per week, 24 instead of 24/7, but it's a vicious cycle. From Bob, what do you say, Jeff?
I think Bob makes a great point, and the book is not real bullish on COs because of my experience. But I write at the end about the difficult life that most of them probably have, and the fact that in the county where I was incarcerated, that was one of the best jobs you could get. And I try to you know, at least a little bit at the end, think about what we would need to do to change the culture inside of prisons. And in fact, in other countries, they have reformed prisons not to make them more humane, not only for the prisoners, but to make them more humane because they saw that the mental health consequences for guards and the rise in suicide on the part of guards was directly related to the terrible conditions inside of prison. And you're right, guards are as miserable in many cases as prisoners, because they have to, you know, they spend their life in there too. So they can go home, so probably not as miserable, but Bob's point is very much, I think, very relevant.
The book is out now. It's called Mr. Smith Goes to Prison: What My Year Behind Bars Taught Me About America's Prison Crisis. If you're like me, you read the book, you'll get to care about all the characters and want to know how it ends up with them. And Jeff does a nice job of at least updating us on the back end of the book on that, because you care about these people. Think about it. We're humanizing prisoners. How about that? Jeff Smith, I hope we can talk again. And as time goes forward and we talk about different reforms that are proposed, maybe we'll bring you back on this program to weigh in on some of these different matters, because I know they're important to you and they're important to our listeners as well. Thank you so much.
I would love that, Evan. Thanks so much for having me on.
All right, the book's out now, Mr. Smith Goes to Prison. Thanks to our engineer, Valerie Labanca, and producer Megan Mack. I'm Evan Dawson. Thanks for listening to Connections on member-supported public radio.